guest, the violin superstar Anna-Sophie Mutter, dominated the New York music scene last month with concert performances with the New York Philharmonic, and then with her Carnegie Hall recitals. And now she's taken her unusual crusade to the country. It's a diet of 20th century music by composers that we've barely heard of, like Wolfgang Riem, Witold Lutosławski, Krzysztof Penderecki, as well as Bartók, Ravel, Stravinsky, and others. This is Maurice Ravel's Cigan, written in 1924. The challenge here for Anna-Sophie Mutter is to persuade listeners to come on a journey, as she calls it, and then once they're inside the music, she says, they'll be taken by the strength and spirituality, the emotion of these works. In New York, she made the invitation irresistible. This is the same Anna-Sophie Mutter who was a child protege of Herbert von Karajan. She made her debut as a soloist with the Berlin Philharmonic at the age of 13. Then she was enormously well known as a cover girl who enjoyed posing for photographers and said that her sound had something to do with the resonance of wood on bare skin. She is now a grown-up, complete master of the violin, introducing us to 20th century music. This is the short course on the 20th century, a new look with the violin at the center with Anna-Sophie Mutter. Connection listeners, are we ready to trade Beethoven for Bartók and Schubert for Schoenberg, or is that what it's all about? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255, or 1-800-423-TALK, the 20th century violin connection with Anna-Sophie Mutter. Welcome.
Hello.
Have I got Anna-Sophie Mutter right?
Yes.
Close enough.
Yeah.
Welcome. The Ravel, of course, it's most of a century old by now.
Yeah.
How hard is that for most people to listen to, do you think?
I think as a musician, it is terribly difficult to get into the listener's chair and imagine how they feel about music. They haven't been trained to analyze, and they haven't been living with for 20 years of their life or 30 years of their life. But one thing is for sure, that Cigan mirrors very much the eternal spirit of music, which is song and dance.
Cigan, certainly
music.
Gypsy.
Yeah. And which, when it comes back to it and down to it, is the root of all great music. It always has been song and dance. And you find most of these elements in other great pieces. But the Cigan is a chant of a gypsy. The wonderful connection, the personal connection I have with this piece is related to the violin I'm playing, a Strat from 1710, which was owned by the woman for whom Ravel wrote Cigan, Jenny Darani, a Hungarian violinist. So it's quite exciting to play it today on the fiddle on which it might have been premiered about 80 years ago.
Well, that helps. I mean, it makes a connection with Bartók, who wrote gypsy music, and Brahms,
who also wrote the second sonata for Jelly Darani. I mean, there's a strange coincidence. It's both these composers have written for the same Hungarian violinist. And you see also how important it has been in the past, and that shows the path for the future, that great artists have been an inspiration for composers. Look back in Beethoven's time, where the Kreutzer Sonata, which was originally written for Bridgetower, who was a prodigy and came to Austria, this Kreutzer Sonata would have never been written if not for Bridgetower. That then a woman came in between Beethoven and Bridgetower, and Bridgetower lost the dedication because he got the woman, and Beethoven got all upset and decided, no, he's going to take the dedication away and give it to Kreutzer instead. That's another story. But just the existence, the mere existence of that violinist and also of Ferdinand Ries for the Opus 96 was enough for a great composer to write specifically. And that is something which has happened in the last century in a large scale. If we, for example, look at Gidon Kremer, and if we look at the last century altogether, it's amazing to see that never before music has been so varied, so different, so daring. It's
Can I make
like
another connection with the Kreutzer Sonata?
Yes, go ahead.
The Kreutzer Sonata is also the title of a Tolstoy story about the Kreutzer Sonata, in which a man discovers his wife playing the Kreutzer Sonata with
With a friend. I mean,
with a friend,
yeah, nothing,
yes.
Nothing wrong there.
Well, except he knows by the way they're playing it, such passionate music, violin and piano music, that they have to be lovers. And so he kills.
Yes, but there was nothing between the man and the woman, nothing between the lines. I mean, the story leaves it open. But the great thing of the story is, for my opinion, I hope you agree with that, that there's so much passion in it.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
And that this gets back... misleadingly.
Well, no, I mean, I sort of assumed that the man who committed the murder was right, that you couldn't play that music without being touched by the mad passion of it.
What do you mean, if he was right?
Well,
should we kill the pianist all the time?
No, but it's a question of sort of locating the dancing passion in modern music. Once we locate that, and I must say, now here I'm just blowing smoke, as they say in America, flattering you, but your performance of these pieces does make them enormously more approachable. I don't know.
I can't compare I've never tried to compare my interpretation to my colleagues, and that's probably absolutely senseless. One thing is for sure that the fact that some of the important pieces of the last century have been written for me in mind and have been premiered by me have enabled me as a violinist to develop very strong own viewpoints and to set a kind of tradition for the way in which these violin concertis or sonatas should be performed in the future.
Let's be very specific about a piece that was written for you. You premiered it, but it also, we're told, changed your life in significant ways. The work of Witold Lutosławski, Polish composer who died in 1985, but well before that, he singled you out with the help of a Swiss conductor to perform this work. And you've talked a lot about what this music meant to you, how it made you a modern in a certain way. I'd love to play a piece called Chain 2, but I'd like you to introduce it and talk a little bit about how the music of Lutosławski and then the man himself changed your life.
Yeah. I met Witold Lutosławski in the early 80s through Paul Sacher, who was a great man in music history of the last century, unfortunately died a year ago. He was the man who is responsible for most of the great symphonic works, like Metamorphosis by Richard Strauss, many of the great pieces by Béla Bartók, and so on and so forth. And he, as being a close friend of mine since I was a teenager, introduced me to most of the great composers who later also started to write for me. So also to Witold Lutosławski. And it was Paul Sacher who called me up in the mid-80s, telling me that he gave this commission to Witold to write a concerto for his Basel Chamber Orchestra in Switzerland and violin, called Chain 2. And as flattered I was in the first moment, I was deadly afraid, of course, because my musical education had stopped somewhere in the 30s. I think it stopped shortly before the Alban Berg. Why? I have not the slightest idea. And I didn't feel any gap or any wide open space I had to cover. It was just something I wasn't aware of, and Paul Sacher was aware of that. Very important missing part in my artistry and in my personality. So I got the score in August, and I was supposed to do the premiere in 86 in January. I was devastated, because it is written in a style which I couldn't relate to at all. It had nothing to do with what I ever had seen before that. Chain 2 is, as the title says, written as a chain. There are interlocking segments of the solo violin and the orchestra, which are time-wise independent. You have bar lines, and you have all the notes written out. But in the ad libitum movements, which are the middle movements of the chain 2, you are absolutely free to start a phrase whenever you want and to repeat it as often as you want, in which this element gives you the illusion of improvisando. It's improvisando in the sense of taking the time you need to take. And it keeps music incredibly fresh. And strangely enough, even if it gets apart, it still interlocks together. It's a wonderful way of incorporating freedom into playing as we had it in the 18th century, where you would compose your cadenzas up to that moment, where you would decorate music to your own liking, where you were, in a sense, much more a composer than only an interpret.
We listened to this piece with great pleasure yesterday and picked a passage toward the end of the second movement.
Yeah.
I'd like to play it. Some artists don't mind talking over their playing, and some do.
I think music speaks for itself. I just want to mention that the end of the second movement got me hooked on Lutoslawski's music.
Well, isn't that interesting? We picked the same moment.
Yeah, that's amazing. It reminded me, I don't want to compare one composer to the other, but just the emotional power of that ending of the second movement reminded me of Richard Strauss' Don Quixote, the death of Don Quixote.
This is terrific. Great. Let's play it, and feel free, obviously, to...
Don't call while it's late.
But you may speak as you like. This is Chain 2 by Witold Lutoslawski, performed by our guest Anna-Sophie Mutter.
And Lutoslawski conducting. Wonderful how that dies out, and then we go into the aria with the orchestra, where there's this extensive solo between violin and cello, where the ad libitum starts, which is like a written out cadenza.
I wonder, did you know when you read the piece, did you have to play it once, did you have to play it 10 times to feel it and to know what you were doing?
It took really long, and I took it from these few bars and basically just worked my way through the score in order to find out how it would sound, because it is important that you have a sound image in your inner ear before you actually do play it in the rehearsal. You just need to know all the different voices of the orchestra. And during the time in which I was now doing Lutoslawski in New York, I realized how well I know the piece by now. It really is under my skin. It's so cleverly written also for the instrument. There are many non-vibrato passages, very pale colors, which probably were present in my personality in the 80s, but they just weren't asked for. They were kind of asleep there. And Lutoslawski woke that up.
Do you play it from memory now, the way you would a Brahms concerto, or do you bring the music with you?
In Lutoslawski, I can play by memory. Other pieces, though, no. It's just so terribly complex. I wouldn't say that Beethoven is less complex, but it is more in our system. It's definitely ingrained in our genes. Whereas a piece by Penderecki, I'm struggling with to nail that down to every single note.
We're going to get to the Penderecki, too. A little later in the program, but I'd also like, for myself, and I think probably for a lot of listeners, we get away from new music, and we have to retune our heads rather substantially and immerse ourselves in it to get back in this century. Do you have that experience or not?
No, for me, music by George Crumb, for example, who wrote this wonderful Night Nocturnes out of the 60s, that's just a natural development out of the tradition of Beethoven, Brahms, and Debussy. And if you look at the composers I'm also playing here in Boston, look at Abo Pärt, for example. He was a great admirer of Bach, and Webern was studying medieval music. These guys understood that no matter how much they would experiment with the form and how minimalistic they would get, and even serial music, it is based on a tradition. You can only break with it if you know it. Most important, although, is the connection between the spirit and the intellect.
We should play the Alban Berg Violin Concerto, which you say, as you say, it doesn't exactly come right out of Bach, but he comes out of Bach, and certainly...
And he uses the Bach choral. I mean, the Berg Concerto is one of the pieces where you, as a listener, can probably relate very quickly to because of the story. And it always helps. There are not always stories to tell about a specific piece, but in that case...
Let's bring it up and tell us the story as you like. This is the Berg Violin Concerto of 1935, in which... Anna Sophie Mutter performs with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by James Levine.
Yeah, that piece has been written for an 18-year-old girl, the daughter of Alma Mahler. And this girl died. Berg was very depressed by that fact, and he wrote a kind of... he wrote the concerto in her memory, not only in the memory of an angel, but as a description of her life. The first movement is the joyful life, the Kärntner Ländler, the very Austrian way of charming music. But the second movement already mirrors the fight with the illness, the devastation, and it culminates in terrible clusters in the orchestra. And then this Bach choral emerges from a cantata whose title is God, take me away, I can't take it anymore, it's too much. And he incorporates that Bach choral. And you can hear that also in the winds now. The Bach choral is repeated very often in a reversed order, like a red thread going till the very, very end of the piece. Then the violin is alone in the last few bars and just emerges like the soul is emerging from the dead body.
Mm. It helps to have you talk about it. It helps to have you decode it in a certain way, emotionally.
I think it helps to know the story before you actually go in the hall and or take the CD and listen to it. And it was Berg's last piece, so it is also his requiem.
Our guest, Anna Sophie Mutter, the famous violinist, is touring the United States after a triumphal January in New York. In the course of 20th century music, it's the last century now. It's safe. We're safe.
Yes, that's
can
it.
We listen? 1-800-423-8255. The Back to the Future or Ahead to the Past violin connection with Anna Sophie Mutter. Marty is calling from Spokane, Washington.
Hi, Miss Mutter.
Hi.
My question for you regards the performance of this music by sort of future generations and young performers.
Yeah.
When it takes so much energy and time to bring this music into your repertoire, into your musical vocabulary, and you really aren't financially rewarded or rewarded in terms of performance and recognition, how do you see young performers tackling that issue and problem?
As I tackled it when I was young, you just go for it. You do what you believe in as an artist, no matter if they are throwing tomatoes at you on stage. There are also great pieces of composers you might not relate to. I mean, it is a very, very personal choice, and it is a very personal fight you are doing for things you believe in. And I try to help the young generation following in that tradition of premiering pieces by also editing them and adding my fingerings and my bowings, which makes the study of the piece way, way easier and much quicker.
I wish you'd speak very candidly about what you went through in your own career. You were a famous player. You had superstar standing, but you also did...
I'm not born.
No, exactly. But by the time you embraced 20th century music... But I gather you also took a very hard stand with concert people and recording artists. If they didn't want to do your kind of your preference, you could think of other things to do, and you walked away until they came back.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to spend more time with my children. It is sometimes the case, and understandably, because playing contemporary music takes a lot of dedication also from the orchestra members, a lot of extra hours of rehearsal, and extra hours of rehearsal always cost extra money. So for a presenter, it's sometimes just not possible to go through this extra effort. And one of the reasons why I then started to include contemporary music more and more in my recital repertoire is the one that having this music played with orchestra is going to be a rare case. I came to contemporary music relatively late in my life, but thanks to God I came to it at all. And since then, I've realized how limited also my possibilities are, and that I want to constantly enlarge my viewpoints.
It's still a battle. It's still a battle with modern art, with modern painting.
Isn't it much less problem with modern painting?
Well, I think everybody goes through it differently. I mean, the Museum of Modern Art in New York is a very, very popular place these days, but it takes everybody
but we seem
time
to be much
and effort to come to terms with
oriented.
That stuff. Well, I wonder. I guess I want you to take us all in hand here as students, eager students who would like to get through the barrier of listening to that music as music.
You know, the connection
trick?
Between painting and contemporary music has been always very strong. Famous relationship was Schönberg and Kandinsky, who in their own ways, in the same moment in time, liberated their art from form, as did Schönberg with the serial music, and Kandinsky did it with his way of painting. And you can follow this path till this day. There is much similarity found in these two arts. But I feel very strongly that we are, as we are visually oriented, much more inclined with the painting and much more open-minded in terms of accepting the alienness of that piece of art, then we would be open-minded to go to a piece of music.
Well, when we play some more music after the break, we'll talk about it very concretely. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. The 20th Century Music Connection with the violinist Anna-Sophie Mutter. Ken is listening online in Hong Kong. First call, I think, from Hong Kong, Ken. Thank you.
Wow, that's exciting.
Oh, well, I'm glad to be a first. great show, as usual, Christopher.
Thank you, Ken.
I must say, Anna-Sophie Mutter, it's nice to hear you talking about this music, and it's wonderful that someone as prominent as yourself champions new music. For me, I had a backwards order to what I hear everybody talking about. My first experiences with this music were Bartok and Elliot Carter, that sort of thing, and it's only now that I can listen to Bach and Mozart and enjoy it. But I wanted to ask you, I know you've recorded many of the pieces that have been mentioned so far, but I was wondering if you had any plans to commission any new pieces or record any new works that have been written?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm sort of in waiting line with a few important pieces like the Violin Concerto by Sofia Gubadulina. I just recently got a message from her that this will be finished around 2004. and Pierre Boulez is writing on a piece, but one which is going to come up very, very soon in terms of world premiere is the Penderecki Sonata. This was scheduled for the recital in Carnegie in January, a commission by me for Lambert and myself, violin and piano. It never arrived in time, so we had to postpone the premiere, and this is going to take place now in April. That's the next one, and probably also the next contemporary piece I'm going to record. After that, it will be a commission I gave to Sebastian Carrier, a wonderful American composer. He's young, he's in his mid-30s, a very inventive, very independent composer, who will certainly incorporate also much of modern age in his composition, meaning also electrical violin, all sorts of gadgets and enhancement, acoustical enhancement and all of that. And I certainly look forward to working with a composer who is of my generation, too, because that will be a very different sound image.
Ken, I wonder if you were nominating yourself here as a composer she ought to take note of.
No, certainly not. Not by a long shot.
Are there names you want to suggest to her?
Those are good names that she's mentioned already. I was also wondering if you've ever done any or would plan to do any other chamber music string quartets. I mean,
I actually do.
Much have this feel to themselves almost. I mean, Kronos is a bit more commercial, but I mean, somebody recording for Deutsche Grammophon that would record some quartets by some of these composers would be wonderful, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there are great quartets, as you mentioned them, out there, and this is never going to be one of my main fields. But I miss chamber music whenever I leave the field. So a piano trio is going to happen next year with Lynn Harrell and Lambert Orcus. And my real dream is, you know, to finish my life with the life as a musician, with the string quartets by Beethoven.
We're going into the break on the Berg. Ken makes an interesting point. He said he grew up on Bartok and Elliot Carter, and then went back to discover Bach and Mozart. I want to know after the break how Bach and Mozart sound to you after your re-education in 20th century music. Anna Sophie Mutter is our guest. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. For The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
From Boston University,
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Century Music Connection with the violinist Anna-Sophie Mutter. This is a piece called Gesungene Zeit, a time chant, written about 10 years ago by the German composer Wolfgang Riem, written for Anna-Sophie Mutter, who performs it here with the Chicago Symphony under James Levine. Tell us about this piece and make this a little exercise in how we should listen to new music.
Riem, whom I knew for quite a while, was always attracted to the high register of my instrument. My Strat has a very brilliant E string, and a part of that fact, I have a kind of affinity to the high register, playing up there with a substance which is also audible in a pianissimo. And what Riem tries to show in his piece is the sculpting quality you have as a string player, because once you touch the note on the string, the whole life is in front of you. That's in contrary to the piano. Once you touch a note there, once you touch the key, it's going to deteriorate. And on a string instrument, you can sculpt the sound. Much of what Riem has written in Gesungene Zeit are very spare notes, very few notes, but there is so much dynamics going on within one note that it's almost really like sculpting the sound. There are only a few outbursts like that, what we hear there. And he plays really with the coloratura registers of the violin, also including flageolets. Harmonics, I think they're called in English.
The orchestral outburst like that, as you call it, only make us listen more carefully to what you're doing.
Yeah.
And it seems miraculous. It's like the finest silk thread we've ever imagined in sound.
It lives much from, of course, from the lyrical quality of the violin and basically also the noises in the orchestra. I mean, it's the drama, the dramatic backdrop in which the flower of the violin can really bloom in front. That's basically the characteristics of the piece.
You keep saying that, or I think what audiences keep responding to in your playing is that you bring out some very, very powerful human emotions in this rather abstract music.
I wonder if it's
what
abstract.
Is it we're feeling here?
Why do we think it's abstract? Only because it's alien? I don't think it's abstract in the sense of being only existing only for the form, just showing a new new form of writing. There's much emotion in it. I was trained in the schooling of Carl Flesch, a schooling which favors very much the expressivity of an interpretation.
Yes.
And nurtured artists like Henrik Schering. It's nurturing the singularity of a personality. As much as you, of course, are serving the composer, but I was trained in a way in which I was always asked for my own opinion. Mm. And I was always attracted to the colors you can achieve, like the sound colors in a human voice. And that, of course, is something which adds much to a piece like the Ream. Just the ability to have so many colors and tools at hand that this music is actually living and transmitting emotion.
No wonder. I mean, no wonder you make it work so. I've heard you say, in effect, that all of this music should touch emotions, which is not to say necessarily flatter them or
no, absolutely
them.
Not. Yeah.
But
speak.
Once the listener yeah. is inside them, he or she will feel the strength and the spirituality of this work. What should we be hearing here?
It would be wonderful if we could listen like children. You know, I have two small children, and they are absolutely uninflicted by any kind of hearing habits or prejudice, or they don't mind. They have no idea who Penderecki is, or Beethoven, or Schubert, if he's living or not. So they enjoy going to a rehearsal of Ream, and they think it's great fun, actually. They are open-minded. It is difficult to shake off the preset mind. Even if we go to listen to a Beethoven sonata, we are preset. We have heard a certain interpretation. We want to have that repeated, please. And if not, we might feel disturbed. And it's much, much more so the case with music with which we haven't lived as long, which we haven't been exposed to on a regular basis.
1-800-423-8255 makes the 20th Century Music connection with the violinist Anna-Sophie Mutter. 1-800-423-TALK. George is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, George.
I enjoy your show very much. I guess I'm going to be the Philistine in the audience here. I have not heard a great deal of 20th Century Music. I have heard some. But certainly all the pieces that have been played this morning confirm my impression that it basically all sounds like the soundtrack to an anxiety attack.
Who is you? Ours or yours?
I'm not sure why, from a structural or theoretical standpoint, that should be the case. I mean, it's certainly not because it's improvisational. I mean, modern jazz doesn't sound like that, and it certainly doesn't have that effect. But I would invite each of you or any listener to perform the thought experiment of simply visualizing a movie as you're listening to this, and I guarantee you that you will have, you know, broken mirrors and horrible scenes. I mean,
be careful. Now, she asked you an important question, George. Does it sound like your anxiety attack or hers? I mean, to me, the most comforting, the most persuasive part of these performances is that she sounds as if she could be out on a sunny, open field. She could be walking on the beach. She could be playing with her children. It does not sound as if she's having an anxiety attack.
But, you know, listen to Beethoven's music. Listen to the forcefulness of his personality, also to the brutality and the anger and the darkness of his soul. That you can find very easily, obviously, also in contemporary music. That is part of life. That's part of the composer's personality as well as the personality of all of us. And there can be only beauty if there also is darkness. And it is true that there's a lot of drama in the pieces we have heard. But there's also a lot of silence and beauty.
George?
Well, certainly... I can't be certain whether it's a chicken or an egg situation. I mean, I may be conditioned from watching movies that use this type of music to illustrate traumatic scenes.
I would wish
so
they would use that great kind of music.
Cause and effect.
I mean, you're absolutely free to feel whatever you feel listening to music, and we all receive music in a very personal way, as we do with all art forms.
Well, that's certainly true, but I guess my contention, if I have beyond my own personal perception, is that I would guess that most people, rightly or wrongly, have similar perceptions, perhaps conditioned on watching movies, perhaps not, that might account for the fact that the music is not as well received.
Do me a favor, listen to one of these pieces in their entire length, and you will find many other aspects as well as the drama you have mentioned.
Think of kids playing as you listen, George. See what happens. 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK makes the 20th Century Music Connection with Anna Sophie Mutter. Barry is calling from Mystic, Connecticut.
Hi.
Welcome,
hi.
Barry.
Yeah. Miss Mutter, I've seen from your first time here in the United States, and you did the Mozart Concerto with Zhu and Mehta.
In 1980, yep. Mm-hmm.
So long ago. Anyway, my question has to do with abstraction. If this music is abstract, and if it is analogous to abstract art, which to me is abstracted from nature, from our being, our soul. And except I have to tell you that somehow, listening to your playing on this program, my question almost falls dead on the floor because I'm just overwhelmed by what I'm listening to. I still am worried about that abstraction.
Yeah. Think of a Fontana, you know, think of a Fontana painting. Why did he make the slit in the canvas?
Yeah.
Because he wanted to show us the third dimension. This has to do with being human and with looking out for spirituality, and I don't know if you want to call it God, but much of that quality is found in abstract music as well. We just need to be curious enough to know more about it by knowing you are hearing also better. You know, you can only hear what you hear, and there's only so much music. This music can talk to your emotion, but much is also to be understood by pre-concert lectures. These are things which are offered very, very regularly in the U.S., much better than we are trained to do that in Europe, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tool music lovers should use as much as you can.
Yeah. Well, I think about, again, this abstraction from nature. I mean, you and that Stradivarius and your sound, that's completely out of nature, from nature to me.
But well, listen to George Crumb, you know, these great pieces, the Night Nocturne. It's like traveling through insects' world, actually. The way he treats the piano is prepared, and you are using iron wire brushes.
Mm-hmm.
And Lambert has to crawl and make pizzicatos with the strings. It's so imaginative. It's so poetic. It is way different from what you would expect from a piano. But just try to be open-minded and not too turned off by the fact that it's different from what we are all used to hear.
Barry, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Dana is on the line.
Good afternoon. Morning. Hello?
Welcome,
hi.
Dana.
Hi. Yes. Hearing people talk like that reminds me of the point I was going to make, actually. People wondering how to relate to it. Either of you familiar with Leonard Bernstein's six Charles Eliot Norton Chair lectures at Harvard?
Yes.
He saw the 20th century in music as not only a tonal crisis, a syntactical crisis, being a la Noam Chomsky, and also a social and spiritual crisis. And if you're like the fifth lecture, and he's wondering, like he's saying, Mahler foresees the death of his beloved tonality. and forking to the right.
Yeah.
In the sixth lecture, he sees, he calls it music rooted in the earth, confirming like sort of a parallel to Chomsky's idea of a universal grammar, that tonality is a universal music.
Yeah.
Stravinsky sort of saved tonality, as it were, although some people feel he just, was just a cheap artifice. It depends on your viewpoint. I think they're both great. I don't want to take sides, but...
What's the question, Dana?
Well, I just wanted to throw that out, that I really think Bernstein really throws light on the problem that people might have with 20th century music.
Yeah, there is music out there, certainly, which has deliberately turned the back to the audience. No doubt about that. That is music which has only been written because one wanted to experiment. And some of what has been written in the 70s has also, and what Boulez also has said, it's just breaking with the rules, you know. Forget the audience, just go for it. Music has to talk to an audience, and it's true that tonality... We are back to tonality. Look at what has been written in the last 10 years. Music is there to be enjoyed. Also by the players, let's face it. I mean, we go through the ordeal of having to read all these hieroglyphs, and you also want to get something out of it.
Among the late, very late, I mean, 90s music was re-infused with emotion and tonality. Who are your favorites in that, in the sort of the, at the very end of the 20th century?
The question to me?
Yeah, please.
From the violin repertoire?
Please.
Oh, the Paderewski's second violin concerto, of course. That is a great piece because it has a classical form, classical structure of a theme. It has a development. It is very inventive in the way it is orchestrated. You have a dialogue with the percussions and the violin. It has dark humor, a great sense of timing. The ideas are developed not overly long. New ones are introduced. The orchestra has a leading role, not only the role of mere accompaniment, but of a partnership. And it concludes with going back to the main theme in the most wonderful chant you can imagine.
Yeah, we're going to go out with it, the music of Paderewski. But let's take a couple more calls first. 1-800-423-8255. The 20th Century Music Connection with the violinist Anna-Sophie Mutter. Tamara. He's calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello.
Hello, Tamara.
Hi. I'm so glad to speak to you. I'm thrilled to hear you play the Berg on television the other day. About 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And one gentleman was calling. He said everything sounded like an anxiety attack to him.
Yes.
And I feel so sorry. I think that your comment about pre-concert lectures is wonderful. They're pieces like the Berg that have a very personal story, which you talked about on the television interview.
Yeah.
And I wish if that gentleman could maybe choose a piece that has a story in the background.
And also hear it in its entire length.
Yes.
It is true that you will also find anxiety attacks and lots of voltage in parts of the Berg concerto, which is so intended, which
he's
is
so angry. I think he sounds so angry at God. And then that beautiful Bach chorale. It's breathtaking.
Yeah, it certainly is one of the great pieces of the last century. I would wish that we all would have the possibility also at school to be more trained in classical music and maybe, you know, get the informations in time rather than having to be exposed at it at an adult age. And very often then we don't make the choice for classical music because we did never have the choice when we were a child.
I think you're right. I'm lucky because I play in an orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So I have time to get to know pieces in the rehearsal a little bit. Maybe, you know, I wouldn't have liked the Berg Violin Concerto the first time I heard it if I didn't know anything about it.
You know, I must confess to you that 15 years ago, when I was in my 20s, I tried to study the Berg. I hated it.
Are you serious?
Yes. Of course, I was an idiot, and I probably partially still am an idiot. But what the Berg concerns, I'm appalled about that fact. But it is true. I just didn't understand it. I had no clue whatsoever. It rushed by me. I listened to it, and I thought, what's the big deal? And then Ludoslavski came up, and I also started to study scores much more thoroughly. And that helped me to acknowledge the fact that the Berg concerto is so well written, with such thoughtfulness, also with such wit. And then the emotions came into the picture. And once that clicked, there was no way out of love for Berg. But it took me a while as well.
Well, if it takes you a while, it can take us a while. Yeah. And let's stick with it. Tamara, I wanted to ask Anna-Sophie Mutter how the new music makes you hear the old music with different ears. I mean, it's not as if Beethoven didn't know anger or Mozart didn't know deep, deep soulful mystery and inquiry and doubt. And
it has been written with a refinement, though, for details, which is sometimes not intended in today's music. And if I play Mozart, it still is the most difficult music in the world. There's so little in the score. I mean, little also in terms of orchestration. No big fuss. You don't have 20 percussions on stage and you know, double horns and the wind section doubled and everything is loud and very impressive. No, it's very delicate. It is beautiful music. But it also has the darkness of his dramatic life. It is certainly the root of everything.
When you go back to the great repertory pieces of
I enjoy
Tchaikovsky,
them even more.
Brahms, Beethoven, exactly. Yeah, what are you hearing and what are you playing, do you suppose, in the grand old concert hall repertory that you weren't playing before?
In the romantic repertoire, it certainly I'm much more willing to take risks also in terms of being very deliberately colorful. Also much more taking risk in terms of tempis, because what I have learned from living composers is that many of the infos you get in the score, if there are any at all, specifically also the tempo infos, to be taken very, very carefully. Much of what is written is going into print before there is a world premiere. And composers don't have often a clue to how their piece is going to actually sound. And they set the metronome and you find out later it's just not going to work. I think you have to take more responsibility as a soloist than ever before today.
And now finally, the Penderecki. I wish you just introduced this, the Metamorphosen.
We already are at the end of the last movement, which concludes everything. And, oh my God.
Maybe there's nothing to say.
wait a few bars and then we come back to the main idea of the whole piece. Now it's leading into the last chant of the piece. It's like an after song. After all this drama and the large cadenza, just listen to it for a second.
Just listen. And thank you, Anna-Sophie Mutter. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up next on Here and Now, the threatened loss of federal funding for the Big Dig, and an advocacy group lists its top female choices to be potential running mates for the presidential candidate.